Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and welcome back. It's episode 101. We're back from our Venice hiatus. And yes, we're going to do one of those episodes that Dan and I love, which is hyper-focused on Chicago. It's a heck of a town. But Dan, who are our guests for this week?
Our guests are Robert Sheriff and Williams Barron, who are the primary movers behind the book, The Wrigley Building, The Making of an Icon, a very handsome Rizzoli edition of well over 300 pages, beautiful photography. 400 pages. Over 400 pages.
At four. I think it's 397 to be precise.
We could put in a couple spacers and get it up to 400 probably.
It started off as 150 pages.
Phenomenal. Well, as some of you may know, the Wrigley Building is a Chicago icon. The building that was developed as the headquarters of the Wrigley Chewing Gum Company, constructed in 1921 by the firm Graham Anderson, Probst & White, although the story that is told in this book sheds a light on an architect who was actually on the staff of that firm, Charles Beersman, who was quite an individual himself and distinguished himself with this building and a couple of other great works. But I think I'm underselling it, actually. The Wrigley Building, The Making of an Icon, is really about more than just an architect and his work of architecture. It's actually also about the meaning of the building to the city, the kind of stories that have developed around it. It was a broadcasting center for several radio stations in the early days of radio. It was the original home of the Arts Club of Chicago, or maybe the second home. And it's lived a lot of lives. So these gentlemen here to tell the story. Let's start. So first of all, how did this book come together? Why is it time to write about this spectacular building now?
I mean, it came about largely because Joe Mansueto, the founder of Morningstar, bought the building 10, 15 years ago, and was giving a tour of the building to the architect John Vinci, who was a close friend of ours. This was all 4 or 5 years ago. And John actually made the suggestion that the Wrigley Building actually is the most famous building in Chicago, probably, but it has never really had a book. It's not been studied before. I mean, it's 100 years old, but there's basic information about it that people don't know. I mean, which is a pretty unusual situation.
Is it the best known building in Chicago? That's my first question, actually, overall is it an icon, or what makes it an icon? Because I think for the four of us, like, you know, I was raised in the South Suburbs. My mother worked for 15 years in the National Association of Realtors building. So I've walked by the Wrigley Building so many times, but I feel like it doesn't quite get its due. To outsiders of Chicago, is it particularly famous to them? And even on Michigan Avenue and its stretch, I feel like it's overshadowed by the Tribune Tower and its famous, you know, competition there. So, I mean, is the Wrigley Building really gotten its due? And why should we make the case that it should be more famous? Because the analog that jumps out at me is like the Woolworth Building in New York, in the sense of vaguely similar in characteristics, but another sort of iconic, in that case, former tallest building in the world that's much more overshadowed by later buildings, et cetera, there. So why the Wrigley Building, and what is its claim to iconic stature? I would love to hear the argument, make the case.
No argument. I mean, you know, it was the first building on Michigan Avenue after the completion of the avenue in the early 1920s. It was the tallest building in the city when it was put up. It was occupied by the Wrigley Company, which was an extremely high-profile company. And the design is extraordinary. I mean, if you look at the site plan, it's complete. First of all, a true Beaux-Arts building is completely symmetrical. I mean, that's the first thing they teach you in a Beaux-Arts class. The Wrigley Building is completely asymmetrical. I mean, Philip Wrigley, the son of William Wrigley, described it as cockeyed all the way around. And it is. I mean, the original building is three unequal sides. There's no right-hand corners. And just by a series of sort of subtle design, I'm not going to call them tricks, but I mean, ways of looking at it, I mean, It has four different sides, and each side is different. I
And the
mean,
elevations are different. I mean, it's symbolic because it's the first building that was built over when the bridge was built, when there was nothing there. That was a complete factory, filthy, disgusting industrial neighborhood. And to the legend of it all, Charles Beersman, Wrigley, for you, Charles Beersman, builds a white porcelain building, like a piece of Dresden china. And it had to be scrubbed 4 times a year, the filth, the soot, so bad. But Wrigley, being a marketing genius, used that, getting the, it was in the paper, they're cleaning the Wrigley building. And then also, the unusualness of getting a cab at the airport, you can say, take me to Wrigley building. 99% of every cab driver is going to tell you where to go, where he knows where to go. So it starts to go that direct. Over 10,000 people a day walk in front of the Wrigley on that side of the sidewalk.
Yes.
There's all kinds of, I mean, we can go on and on, but also it's a visual one-off in Chicago. It doesn't follow the first Chicago school. It goes back to the Renaissance, goes back to the 14th century, and it's Beaux-Arts. So it has a language, a visual language. It not only is it structural, working in a classical term or classical language, it also is embellished with hundreds and hundreds, thousands of cartouches with objects, animals, birds, fishes, things that all have meaning. Every one of them represents a word. So, like the cartouches are, I mean, when you enter the building through the arch, over the arch are all these different images, all these terracotta birds, fish, everything. And they represent a moral message to the people coming in. So it extends past the physical material to a message being said in a language. So it has its own energy. Does that help?
But it was never, I mean, a Chicago school building. I mean, it had more in common with buildings in New York, buildings in San Francisco, of course, buildings in Europe. I mean, it's not a building that the Chicago school appreciated. That's why it has never really shot its due. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright probably would have hated it, okay? I mean, but obviously he's not the ultimate judge. I mean, it's an extraordinary building. I mean, there's nothing like it in Chicago. I mean, just the care and the attention to detail that went into it. It's handmade. I mean, I forget, what is it, 300, 400,000 individual pieces of terracotta are on that building.
So the building is, yeah, it's
And each one was hand molded.
every piece of
I mean,
terracotta had to be
yeah.
pressed into a mold, baked, and then it warped, then it had to be glazed, and then they had to take all those pieces before they were shipped out to the site, make them fit together to come together.
Each
You
one
can't have
is
done that.
numbered so that they would know where to place it on the steel frame.
And like
I
contemporary
mean,
buildings, they come in on a truck, they put up the pieces, the curtain wall goes up. This is a work of art. This is a sculpture. I'm sold. I am sold on this. Okay, we
Sold.
have
Sell me another
established.
building.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I was gonna say
Well,
that.
no,
Now,
you have an
I've.
emotional, you have an emotional response to something with art. You can look at something and say, oh, I could have done that. Or you can be standing in front of a Picasso or a Giacometti and say, wow, how did they do that? And that's the bounce you get off the Wrigley building. People, you can't look at it as a whole because of all its different angles and everything, but you respond to it positively. It's a beautiful object. And the reason it's a beautiful object is all the components and the pieces, how they're assembled visually for weight stacking going up and going into the heavens with the clock tower. At the top of the clock tower is a series of a circle, it's the only circle in the whole building, a colonnade that releases the pressure of the vertical angles. I mean, it's one brilliant design move after another. It goes on. At the 14th floor around both buildings, there's a whole cornice of winged eagles with their wings out, floating, holding up that top part of the building. I mean, you have all these visual experiences.
And
It, yes.
I mean, it is a building that's encoded. I mean, with modernism, any kind of historical reference was basically against the law. But I mean, the Wrigley Building is full of historical references. I mean, the two chief ones, of course, are the Giralda Tower in Seville in Spain and Chateau Chambord in the Loire Valley in France. I mean, these were the principal kind of references there, but also the municipal building in New York, which was Stanford White. And I mean, back then, that is the way buildings were designed. I mean, today, a modernist is not supposed to have any historical reference. You're supposed to pretend that you made it up totally out of your own brain. I mean, but with 100 years ago, it was very common for an architect to reference other historic structures.
Well, that's
And how
incredible.
well you did it and the way you did it is the way the building was judged. Very different from today. But I mean, that's why the architecture today in Chicago, in particular, is really so stale and dreary. I mean, the stuff you see going up here today is just—it's sort of pathetic. I mean, kind of this third rinsing of mid-century modernism, and I'm not sure what all. And I think one of the interesting parts of it was discovering this architect, Charles Beersman, who is basically lost to history until we started researching this book, and to find out what his influences were, how he grew up in San Francisco, how he got his first job with Julia Morgan, who was, of course, the first woman to attend the School of the Beaux-Arts in Paris, became, the house architect for William Randolph Hearst, designed Saint Simeon, and the LA Examiner Building in Los Angeles, which was a primary inspiration for the ornamentation of the Wrigley Building. All of this was unknown. That these were all things we discovered in the course of doing the book.
That's why it took 4.5 years.
Why it took 4.5 years.
And we had a wonderful funder that kept, the more we told him, he kept
Saying
saying,
yes.
going, just keep going. And what a great opportunity, right? I mean, what strikes me as being so interesting is that it is an iconic building of Chicago, yet many of its influences are very, unlike un-Chicago, and coming from not just, of course, historical references to the continental Europe, but also other cities where the skyscraper topology was still relatively new, but had been tried out first, on the coasts. It's in some ways it's kind of an import too, which is it's a weird thing to think about. I think one of the more striking things to me reading through all this and thinking about some of the moving forces behind it, you have, Wrigley was a flim-flam man who could sell chewing gum. And then you have Bill Thompson, the mayor of Chicago,
Yes.
who,
The
was
most corrupt
behind
mayor in history.
right. And so like you put those two together and like, well, let's look at today's federal administration and what kind of results do we get from that? And yet in the 20s, putting the flim-flam man and the corrupt politician together produced this beautiful work of art. I was like, what has gone wrong in the interim where we don't at least get the nice thing that the public can enjoy, even if the genesis was, perhaps not the most ecumenical sources.
Well,
You still get
I
beautiful
wouldn't
architecture.
call Wrigley a flim-flam, and
Yeah, it was
I
more
mean
peaky
that's
barn. A successful industrialist.
I yeah certainly that, but I mean I say he had one foot in the 19th century and one foot in the 20th century, and I mean his models were people like Buffalo Bill and P.T. Barnum. I mean chewing gum itself. He always said anybody can make gum. I mean, the trick is to sell gum, and that was what he was great at. And gum, it's not a staple. Nobody needs it. I mean, you have to want it, and he knew how to create that want. And the way you do that is advertising.
But
He was an
also,
advertising genius.
yeah, it was
I
also, I mean,
mean.
he chose the site. Thompson was having a rough time with his election. They get the bridge built. Wrigley gets the site, but he chose that site because you can see it from a mile back from Roosevelt Road going north, and he knew that Michigan Avenue did a tilt, and that would be the only thing he saw was his White Castle sitting there. And then he doesn't put his name on it. He completely blows everybody's mind because he's famous for these
advertising on every building in the country and every train and bus. And you know, he keeps playing with everybody constantly.
One of the really extraordinary aspects was the exterior lighting. I mean, the building is totally lit on all four sides. And not just the top of it, but the whole thing. And I mean, that was new back then. And I mean, the inspiration for it was this massive billboard Wrigley had in Times Square. He had a series of billboards there. One of them was the largest neon installation in the world. But that was always what he wanted. It had to be the biggest. It had to be the brightest. I mean, it had to be something he could brag about. But I say I don't find him a flim-flam man at
No, not
all.
at all.
I find him a fascinating man. There's not even a biography of him. I mean, that's the strange thing. Right after he died, the family commissioned a biography privately, and it was never published.
That is bizarre.
The stuff we were finding out about Wrigley was relatively unknown as well. All of his crazy, early history of panning for gold and running away from home. And he's a legendary character. It's half made up. You have the sense. But I never found him, an evil figure, a negative figure. Just a larger than life figure.
It's a theatrical figure.
Very
I
theatrical.
mean, his panels are Laurel and Hardy.
I mean, that's.
I just want to note, and we're tying those two points back together to Dan's comparison with the current moment. And you're mentioning that Wrigley didn't put his own name on the building. What a stark difference between Trump International, its neighbor, like literally adjacent to the site today. So fascinating to see that contrast historically and et cetera there. But I do want to ask quickly about its later uses. Its sort of quasi reinvention as a sort of broadcast center. How that came about? Was the building particularly suited to that, or simply its function of fame? And then also its later uses before restoration. Because as a child walking by the Wrigley Building on our trips for Christmas, it did have this sort of air of being tired. It was a faded grand dame at the time, and I'm sort of curious how it ended up in that state, given its iconic location, structure, et cetera. I'm unfamiliar with the lives of the Woolworth Building, but I know its lobby has been preserved and is a tourist destination, et cetera, and it's always had tenants. But yeah, what was the overall life of the building itself from Wrigley to Mansueto?
Well, it's a complicated building because it's pretty hard to take care of. To the materials alone. And it was originally six shades of white going up. So it looked like the sun was always setting. I mean, that has dissolved in all the terracotta replacements. But we're talking a really geeky building here. Robert, we jump in here. I'll ramble on.
Well, actually, just the level of detail on the building. I mean, it's. I mean, it. You know, obviously, no argument. I mean, it is the greatest terracotta building in Chicago, without question. Certainly, one of the greatest terracotta buildings in the world. And terracotta was a particular moment in time. I mean, basically, probably 20, 25 years. But I mean, just
Well, no,
the extravagance of the detail is
he
what.
drew every piece of it that was not out of a catalog. He had all that in his head. He was sketching all those dragons, all those fish, all those dolphins, all those little baby faces with angel wings. And it's completely. And what's crazy is all of this, if you have the book and been through the book, you can see up on high up what you can't see. It No one ever
That's the
gets
interesting
to see
thing.
this.
There's so much up there
That,
that cannot be seen from the street.
right, and
That I
there's a
mean.
medieval term or Renaissance term, probably, or it's for the eyes of God.
Yeah, I mean, the
And
Renaissance
again,
architects felt that that was meant not for people, but for God.
and all that detailing, all those objects have, I have a list here, like when you come over the door, the objects represent prosperity, growth, courage, wisdom, enlightenment, and royalty. That's the arch you walk through on your way into your office. That's what they're telling you how your moral compass should be. So all of that radiates out, whether you can see it or not, to me, as it's built into the structure.
And it just, I mean, it's great animation there. The way the sun moves across it,
Well, yeah.
and at different times of the day, you see different parts of it in different
Well,
ways. I
unlike a
mean,
contemporary building, it's almost like origami. As the sun moves,
We did a long 12-hour video of the building. You see it undulating in and out, up and down all day long. Every time, that's why it took me so long to shoot it, because I kept seeing something I didn't see before. Because something appears, then something disappears, and something else comes out. And then a vertical line slowly gets soft, and a new strong one pushes up. I mean, things happen all day. It's animated.
I say the building, I mean, it's subsequent history. I mean, I say in the book that the Wrigley Building is the primary art incubator in the city. When you think about it, when you think about the ocean of commercial art that poured out of that building, but also the fine art and the fine art that was displayed there. I mean, it blows my mind that Picasso's Guernica was displayed at the Wrigley Building in the 1930s. I mean,
I swear there's uranium in the ground. There's something there on that site.
I
Yeah.
said it's
The
and
juxtapositions are pretty amazing. I mean, considering that it's in some ways, kind of an anachronistic, I don't know if anachronistic is the right word. It was just before Art Deco took off, right? And a very different idea about how to
no,
represent.
that's always happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean there are whispers of deco there,
Oh yeah,
certainly, but I mean
there's
it's
one horizontal band that actually quietly is Art Deco that I discovered, and I'm not too sure why that's there. It's an odd touch.
But I mean, it is not a deco building. I mean,
No,
it's a Beaux-Art building.
no, it's completely different than Deco. Deco's machine, more of a machine design.
And I mean, that whole Beaux-Art feeling, most of Daniel Burnham's have some aspect of the Beaux-Art in them. I mean, but they also have that first Chicago school aspect also. This is more purely a Beaux-Art building, even though it is completely irregular. And as I say, it's just the stuff that has happened there over the years. You talked about the Arts Club. I mean, which it was one of the primary showcases for modern art in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, and it was at the Wrigley Building. I mean, WBBM was in there for almost 30 years, and yeah, that's where Columbia Records had their recording studio. And I mean, legendary people recorded there. I
Carter
mean,
family recorded the
yeah,
Wrigley
Carter
Club.
Family, Memphis Minnie. I mean, recordings that are now in the Library of Congress were recorded at the Wrigley Building.
Yeah. And then even up to today, Perkins and Will is in there. Helmut Jahn's son has moved his Jahn into the building. There's all kinds of things. And then also it's a theatrical experience. There's this in the research we found out when Hirzman was young and working for Julia Morgan. He was taking vocal lessons and studying to be a tenor. So he knew opera. He knew Verdi. He knew Wagner. He knew Mozart. He knew this. And I had finally, because I'm visually oriented, the space between the two buildings has an arcade. And if you go to the main opening double page shot, to me, I finally, because I have to put context to my images, there's this huge proscenium arch in that passageway with all these people going through it like the actors. It's completely framing the activity of the animation of the street. It's incredible.
I
It's
mean, the plaza, it's
filmed
an opera
live.
set in a lot of
Oh
ways.
yeah, it's like the curtain pulled back, the back cover of the book. You look at that. I waited until to try to capture the scale. It's like in La Boheme, the curtain pulls back, it's an opera set, and you see this magnitude of scale. It dwarfs the person in glamour. It's elegant.
What was interesting too was, I mean, going back to Charles Beersman, I mean, he died back in 1946, in his mid-50s, and was pretty much forgotten. And it didn't really occur to me that I'd be able to meet somebody who actually knew him. I mean, he died like over 80 years ago, but we actually did manage to track down his daughter, who was still alive, 4 years ago. And she was 92 years old. I mean, she had an astounding memory. She had been waiting to talk about her father her whole life. I didn't know that became a big part of the story. We became very friendly with his granddaughter, Dionne DeMille, and the book is dedicated to her.
I mean, she knew nothing about her grandfather. I mean, we introduced her to her family. That was very moving to me.
And also, we met the building to me, the more I worked on photographing, the more fun and playful it became, and not, stiff and stodgy. And somewhere along the line, we met another family member. He was in his 90s.
Oh yeah, he was in his
Yeah,
90s.
an uncle. And he met Charles, and we said, "What was he like?" And he said, "This man is in his 90s now. He's small, like he's probably 8 or 9 years old." He goes, "You get down on the floor and play with us and roll around and tell us stories." And he was so much fun. And it just confirmed the building is fun.
Yeah,
It's visually
just the playful aspect of
playful
it.
app. Yeah. It's
Yeah.
not seriously, like a store-bought, something out of a box.
But I say that intersection of the river and Michigan Avenue, that is, the Beaux-Art heart of Chicago with the Wrigley Building, Tribune Tower, the London Guarantee Building, and also 330 North Michigan Avenue. I mean, those four buildings together, it's this incredible hub that happens there. And it is kind of the central gathering
Oh, it's
place
the
for
epicenter
downtown
of the city.
Chicago. I mean,
Totally, with the river, Michigan Avenue, and that architecture. No, it's just so many people, and nobody wrote about it. Nobody bothered to look this up. The modernists wanted to tear it down. It was decorative. And so, and I think Charles Bearden was just waiting to grab us, and we fell for it.
Well, I have to ask, as a way of closing, perhaps, is what is its future? Where is it intended? Because it is interesting to contrast it with, Dan and I being former journalists here, to contrast it with the sad fate of Tribune Tower in a way. I mean, obviously converted to luxury condos is not a bad fate, but certainly not its intended use for it. And so, yeah, what do you think the future trajectory of the Wrigley Building is in terms of tenants' uses and where that goes to preserve that iconic building going forward,
Fully leased.
besides?
Well, it's fully leased as an office building today. I mean, it's full for the foreseeable future. I'm pretty sure that's what it'll be. Yeah, the Tribune Tower was a shock. I mean, and it's still strange to think of that building as condominiums.
Well, but I think the Wrigley will continue to be a working space. That's the energy that's
That's
in it.
certainly Joe's plan for it.
Yeah, he's not planning on converting it to something that it's not.
It's interesting. He kind of collects Beaux-Art buildings. I mean, in
Yeah, he owns
addition
the
to
Belden in
Wrigley,
Bradford.
that he owns the Belden Stratford Hotel over on Lincoln Park, and he also purchased the Waldorf, which was designed by Lucien Lagrange, which of course is a modern building but done in a Beaux-Art style. Yes,
Yeah.
he has a style,
I wonder what
and
his stadium's going to be.
yes,
That'd
That's
be
right. That's right. You just set the real estate market on fire with the fire stadium a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, no, it's great. He lives in a modern building, actually, designed by Stanley Tigerman.
Oh, a postmodern building, perhaps.
Well, if Stanley were here, I won't use the language that
Stanley would not
they
approve of the
oh, he
word
would not like what
postmodern.
you
Yes.
said. No, he doesn't like it. We knew Stanley somewhat, and I worked for Stanley occasionally. And I like Stanley. But
But
if you
you
said,
certainly didn't want to get on the wrong side of
we
Stanley.
said postmodern once, and the words flew. You didn't know what you're talking about.
Well,
Go ahead, yes.
one final point there, and I should note here, I do work with Fast Company here, so I am officially in the tank for Mansueto Ventures as well as Joe Mansueto himself. But could you talk a bit about him as a patron of architecture for a moment? Because he does have an interesting collection as well. I wrote about Jeanne Gang's dormitory at the University of Chicago, which I believe was underwritten by a gift from Mansueto, and sort of a, I don't know, at the time I remember writing about it as sort of a, it was designed with various houses and lots of stairs for sitting, and was sort of interesting architecturally as well. So it seems like he's an interesting sort of modern day patron of architecture, both preservation, commissioning, et
Well, the
cetera, there. And I'm
library.
curious your take on that.
And the addition to the library,
Yeah,
which is
Mansueto
by
Avenue.
Helmut Jahn,
That's just, I walk by
that's
it
the
and say, what
Mansueto
is
Library.
that? And he's so, Joe's really smart, obviously. But to see the relation of the Mansueto Library to the Netsch Library from the 70s, it's so beautiful. I mean, it's just incredible. It's the best composition on campus. And I give tours of campus for my students. And But that those two together, thanks to Joe.
That's Joe is definitely our Medici. I mean, architecturally speaking.
That's true.
But I mean, the book, it was, it's very much a collaboration. I mean, it's Bill and I, but Tim Samuelson was also on board as editor and writer, and John Vinci wrote the introduction. And Studio Blue, which is an amazing design firm in town, headed by Cheryl Weiss, designed the book. And it was a very intense collaboration over 4 years. The book was printed in Italy, in Verona, by a top art printer.
Oh my God. We got to go on press.
Yes.
The book
And
prior to our book
yeah.
at this press
I say the book is a work of art itself. It's
was
a
a
work of
book.
art about a work of art,
The machine
basically.
we printed on that book, the book prior to us was a book of printer printed for MoMA, 120 copies at $12,000 a copy.
Yeah, that was the book they printed before
For
ours,
us,
right?
that's the quality of the machine we were on.
I can attest to that. It is a gorgeous book and it's full of stories. It's not just about architecture, it's not just about an architect. It's really about just the intersection of stories that come through this building. The people who occupied it, commissioned it, every aspect of it is sort of flamboyant, theatrical, as you say,
Very much, yeah.
rich, ironic, contradictory. It's kind of got everything. So I want to thank you guys so much for spending the time with us.
And you guys are cool. It's
Thanks,
perfect.
Dan.
Okay.